Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In his shining new book, The Medieval Islamic Hospital, Medicine, Religion and Charity, Ahmed Raghab, Assistant Professor of Religion and Science at Harvard Divinity School, charts the institutional and intellectual history of hospitals or bimaristans in medieval Egypt and the Levant. A central argument of this book is that hospitals in Islamdom were more than just institutions where the sick were treated. Hospitals also served as important sites of communal services and congregation, as urban architectural monuments, and as symbols and expressions of a ruler's political authority. By exploring an astonishing variety and number of sources, Raghab provides an unparalleled window into the aspirations and operations that defined the medieval Islamic hospital. This splendid new book will be of great interest to students of medieval Islamic history, religion and science, medical history, and the study of Islam and religion more broadly. Here now is my conversation with Professor Ahmed Raghab. Hello, Ahmed. How are you doing?
Hi, Sher Ali. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, my pleasure. Really appreciated this book, as I mentioned to you before we went live. This is such an interesting and important topic that not much has been written about. So this was quite a revelation, and the kind of painstaking research you've done is very obvious from the pages of your book. So we have a tradition of new books in Islamic studies that our first question is always biographical. Ahmed, could you share a bit with our listeners your story? How did you become a scholar of Islam and Muslim societies?
So my interest in Islamic studies and in the study of Islam in general came through history of science and history of knowledge. I was trained as a physician in Egypt, and after that I started working on a PhD on history of medicine in Paris. And during my study of history of medicine and history of hospitals, I started to become more and more aware of the importance of connecting or studying science as part of the of society in general, and connecting it to the different intellectual currents, particularly when we're talking about the medieval and early modern period, which led me into thinking more about Islamic studies and about different kind of concerns that we work on when we think about the study of Muslim societies.
So let's begin with a sort of more basic question, which is, what is an Islamic hospital, and what kind of an intervention that you have you tried to make in this field of Islamic hospitals? One of the main arguments that you make in this book is that you're trying to rethink this very category and ways in which it has been approached in the past by scholars. So could you say a bit about this category and the kind of intervention that you see yourself making through this book?
So I would say that in general, if we want to, and this is how really I start thinking in the book with a sort of an operative definition of what Islamic hospitals are, I would say that these are collective sites of collective medical care that cared primarily for patients, but not necessarily exclusively so, and that flourished in most of the Muslim cities and urban centers from probably the 9th century into the 19th century, to the extent that they became a fixture of urban life in these societies throughout these 10 centuries. I think the Islamic hospital we start the book with is, I would say, is quite different from the one that we emerge with at the end of the book, or at least that's what I tried to do. The book tries to question, first of all, or questions really three important things about the category of Islamic hospitals. The first is the coherence of the category, that there isn't one single Islamic hospital that we could paint or think about throughout this entire period, but also even in any given period throughout the entire geography of these Islamic societies. So the book proposes that we have at least two major models that emerged from two different origins, one of them that dominated the medical scene in Iraq and Iran, and the other that was more common in Egypt and the Levant. And although there is a lot of communication between these two models and a lot of cross interactions between them, I try to locate the hospital in its own geography and its own social context, which always creates different expectations and therefore different traditions of hospital making, if you will, in these different geographies. The second point is about the exclusive medical nature of the hospital, which has been a consistent theme in previous scholarship. And one of the reasons why Islamic hospitals were such an attractive, although understudied topic in the history of hospitals in general, that they were seen as exclusively medical. They, for instance, they didn't offer charities for poor who are not sick. They were focused primarily on the sick, and they were always staffed by physicians, at the time humoral galenic physicians. I argue in the book that this focus, this medical nature, is actually a function of inclusion rather than exclusion, in the sense that there's no evidence that anybody was turned away from the hospital because they were not sick and they were only hungry or tired, but because these hospitals emerged and flourished within a network of charity that included mosques and khanaqahs and different and other organizations and institutions that supported the poor, we became, or these hospitals were able to primarily focus on the sick. And therefore, it is their presence within a network of charity, within all these other charitable organizations and, charitable institutions and establishments that did not function or focus on medicine. It is because of these institutions that they emerged as more or less exclusively medical. And the third thing that I try to investigate in the book is the type of medical practice in the hospital, and I make arguments about how it is connected but quite different from practice outside the hospital.
So what were some of the earliest Islamic hospitals, and what kind of precedents from the late antiquity tradition, did they build on, these earliest Islamic hospitals? Could you tell us a bit about some key institutions and what were they modeled on?
So that's an excellent question. There has been quite a debate about the, quote-unquote, the first Islamic hospital, which I think, like a lot of debates about first things, will almost never be resolved. In the book, I argue that there is evidence that says or shows that there were small sites of collective charitable care and infirmaries built under the Umayyads in the major Umayyad centers in Damascus, Jerusalem, Al-Fustat in Egypt, so mainly in Egypt and the Levant. And these were largely emulating sort of Byzantine centers and inheriting Byzantine centers, where the Byzantines regularly built these infirmaries close to big cathedrals and monasteries and so on. In the 9th century and, well, the late 8th and early 9th century under the Abbasids, we see a new institutions that are built in Iraq in particular, and these institutions are modeled on Syriac Sassanid institutions that existed in the region before Islam, basically, from late antiquity, really. And these institutions, or these were actually a part of a patronage practice that the Abbasids inherited, along with a lot of other patronage practices that they inherited from the Sassanids. So these were acts of patronage directed to their own physicians and their own clients, medical clients. In general, we see that the Levantine and Egyptian hospitals were built on the tradition of Byzantine institutions, which were connected to either the empire or the church, and in the case of Islamic institutions, they were largely connected to rulers and sovereigns in the different polities in the region. They were big institutions comparatively, they focused on providing charity or focused primarily on charity, although they had obviously a medical nature, as we described. In the Iraq and Iran context, these were institutions inherited from a Syriac Sassanid tradition, and they were primarily acts of patronage directed to the physicians. They were largely small, not as important in terms of fashioning the image of the ruler, but important for the physicians themselves, and focused primarily on medical care, again, led by
the physicians as opposed to the institutions built in Egypt and the Levant.
Now, one of the very fascinating arguments that you make in this book is that these Islamic hospitals were also architectural monuments, which played an important political function, these bimaristans, as they were called. So could you say a bit about that architectural dimension and how were these urban monuments used and mobilized for the assemblage of political authority and the way in which the contemporaneous political rulers used these for their own self-presentation as pious Muslim rulers at a given time and place?
Right. So the thinking about the architecture of the hospital allows us to, again, further embed them within their own context. The hospitals that we see in the surviving hospitals today that we see, for instance, in Egypt and the Levant are truly huge monuments that were built by powerful and important rulers. And in part, they were actually, what I argue is that they were built as, they were part and parcel of an architectural program or of the architectural programs of these rulers and sovereigns that were connected to their empire building strategies, if you will. So let's take the example of someone like Nuruddin Zanki, for instance, who had a prominent architectural program in Aleppo and then in Damascus as he fashioned each of the two cities as a center of his emerging empire when first Aleppo was the capital and then Damascus. And at the heart of these architectural programs in each of the two cities, he built a hospital. And the hospital, along with a number of other institutions and mosques and madrasas that he built, were part of creating his own image as a pious ruler, but also as a great ruler who would be able to establish these huge charitable monuments or charitable establishments that would benefit his people. The same happens with Salah al-Din when he puts sort of is able to take over the Fatimid Empire and annuls the Fatimid Caliphate completely. Part of his actions in order to sort of erase the legacy of the Fatimids in their own capital, in their own caliphal capital, is an architectural strategy that aims at changing the architectural landscape of Cairo, making it into the Ayyubid Cairo that will be quite different, with a wall, with a citadel, and so on. And part of this strategy was also to dismantle the big monuments of the Fatimids, which included their palaces, for instance, at the center of the city, where Salah al-Din gave them to some of his generals. And he chose one of the most beautiful halls of these palaces, a hall built by Mu'izz al-Din Allah, one of the more beautiful ones, to make it into a hospital. Now, this particular act is actually extremely significant because this is the caliphal palace. This is where the Fatimid imams were buried, and a region that was essentially off limits for poor people, except in very specific occasions. And now it is the center for poor people as they come and flock to the new hospital that Salah al-Din is building. He built another one in Alexandria for the service of pilgrims going to Jerusalem and going to Mecca, again, on his way of establishing himself as the person who would basically support and protect pilgrims. The same happens with Qalawun, who builds a huge monument in Cairo, his big hospital in 1285, which the book focuses on more than any other hospital. But in all these cases, what we see is that these hospitals are part and parcel of these political projects and of these architectural programs that symbolized these projects on the ground.
Let us talk a bit about the administration and management of these bimaristans. And one of the most instructive things that you accomplish in this book is your very fascinating reading of Waqf documents, which tell us a lot about how did these administrators imagine the functions and objectives of these bimaristans. So could you talk a bit about that aspect of your book, the administration of these bimaristans?
That's a great question. I think the Waqf documents obviously is don't tell us about the day-to-day practices. They tell us about the ideal picture of what the practice should look like. So it is not
I don't look at it as an indication of how the daily activities of the Bumaristan took place, but it showed us, as you mentioned, the priorities of these administrators, what they thought the hospital ideally should be doing. And here again, there is quite a significant divergence between these two models that I described earlier, the Eastern or sort of a model, Iranian and Iraqi model, and the model in Egypt and the Levant. And you can see this through a comparison between the Waqf document of Rashiduddin Tlaib, Bimaristan that he built in Iran, and the Bimaristan, contemporary Bimaristan built by Mansur Qalawun in Cairo in 1285. While Rashiduddin Tlaib Bimaristan focused, or the Waqf document focused primarily on the medical education, setting limits for the time that these students can spend in the hospital, focused on the actual medical supplies there, the salaries for the physicians and so on, and determined these in details, and paid largely little attention to the maintenance of the organization itself, apart from few stipulations to make sure that peasants don't migrate and leave the lands that they are sort of farming. Qalawun's hospital in Cairo was primarily focused on the on the maintenance of the institution itself. So its main focus was the administration. Basically, the document paid a lot of attention to how the administration is structured, how much it is paid, how it is paid comparative to any other institution of that size, and it was the biggest in the country at the time. So presumably it's the people at the top of this organization were the highest paid in the entire Mamluk Empire for some time. And it focused also on the infrastructure that supported patients in terms of beds, walls, covers, types of food, even things to cover the food so that it protects it from flies and so on. And finally, it started to pay attention to physicians and medical supplies. Now, I don't argue that these administrators imagined the hospital functioning without physicians. However, this very clear priority setting that they do in the Waqf document shows how they think about the hospital as primarily a charitable institution that wants to support the poor, that wants to maintain an active role and active intervention in the lives of the poor, and not only a medical organization or a medical institution. And that shows actually even in the biographies that we see later on, a couple of centuries, or sort of in the 14th and 15th and centuries and beyond, that the big physicians, the important physicians, which are highly paid, come to these hospitals to work only as a form of charity, because simply hospitals are unable to afford them. And all hospitals are talking, people writing about hospitals are always talking about their inability to pay physicians decent salaries. And we have numbers of salaries that show that they are, compared to salaries that physicians would make in the court, for instance, are really almost negligible. And again, because these hospitals perceive their role as largely part of this large charitable network that we talked about in these cities at the time.
Let us talk a bit about these physicians. And you, in very interesting ways, shows that many of these major physicians were also also scholars in their own right. So we could call them scholar doctors in many ways. Right. So who were some of these major physicians? You focus on a few and one in particular. And what are some of the key features of their intellectual, the texts that they're reading, the kinds of discourses and discussions they're having? Could you say a bit? I know you spend a lot of time on this in your book, so it's a bit unfair to ask you one question here. But if you could give us some highlights of who these people were, what they were reading, and the kinds of intellectual networks that we are talking about here.
Right. So I argue in the book, or I trace in the book, a particular circle of physicians that formed around Bimaristan and Muri in Damascus, and that came to dominate the medical practice in Egypt and the Levant under the Mamluks for a few centuries to follow. And basically, their students came to dominate not only hospital practice, but also other forms of medical, at least elite medical practice, that is, medical practice directed to richer clients. This circle, which I call in the book the Khwar circle, because it is around, or was the most prominent figure was Muhaddab ibn al-Dakhwar, who was a physician that served in that died in the first half of the 13th century, and that served in al-Bimaristan al-Nuri, but also was a very important figure in the Ayyubid, in the Zangid and then Ayyubid courts of the period. He himself was a student of Ibn al-Mutran, a known physician. We know a lot about his writings. And Ibn al-Mutran was a student of Muhaddab ibn al-Naqqash, where this story actually, or this genealogy, starts. And Naqqash was recruited by Nuruddin Zanki when he built al-Bimaristan al-Nuri, was recruited from Baghdad to come and supervise the establishment of this new institution. And Naqqash himself descends from a long line of prominent Bimaristan physicians in Baghdad, and his direct teacher was Ibn Tilmidh. Again, I don't want to say too many names, but Ibn Tilmidh was, again, a very famous and important physician in his own right, and built a whole tradition in Baghdad and served in a lot of hospitals. So, as al-Naqqash left from Baghdad to Damascus, created a new genealogy in Damascus around the Bimaristan al-Nuri, of which al-Dakhwar became the most important figure. He brought with him, first of all, a discursive understanding and appreciation of the project of the Bimaristan. That is to say, what role the Bimaristan plays in the life of the physician. This was mixed or interacted with the charitable role, the highlighted charitable role that hospitals played in the Levant and Egypt, and allowed for these Bimaristans to become the charitable cornerstone of the practices of these important physicians moving forward. He also brought with him a number of important texts or editions and recensions of texts that were not known in the Levant before. So, for instance, we see in the circle the emergence of a book like Al-Hawi, and Al-Hawi was composed by Abu Bakr al-Razi a couple of centuries, two centuries before, was quite well known, but it was known to be basically an amalgamation of all his pamphlets and writings that was collected by his students after his death, completely useless and very, very difficult to deal with. Yet, the copy that we see, or the new recension of this volume that we see with this particular group, is quite different because it is organized according to body part, and it is actually the edition that we have in our hands today, not the original edition that presumably emerged after Razi's death. So this is one example of these new books that they are bringing, or sort of new recensions of books, new ordering of the intellectual environment, which all aim to serve a particular emphasis on practice as opposed to theory. So Razi's book become, in this new recension, a primary reference book for practice. It is organized along body parts. They are able to reference it and go back to it. We have, for instance, a new book that is attributed to al-Razi, although there is no way of knowing whether it was indeed composed by al-Razi, but it is a collection of cases. And it is the largest collection of cases that we have. And it is produced during the same period by another physician who claims to be copying it from manuscripts by al-Razi. And again, this is a sign of the emergence of new case writing that these physicians engage in. Very few of them actually survive because they were seen as practical texts that they worked with and then presumably didn't really care enough to preserve, except for major things like al-Razi's cases. But it shows a new intellectual orientation for these physicians that focuses now on practice, that understands the importance of observation, and of physical examination in order to diagnose, and that pays a lot of attention to diseases as separate categories that can be treated by specific medication. So the focus now is on to cure a disease as opposed to treat a patient, which has been the ethos of Galenic practice for a very long time. So I would argue that this particular period and this specific circle, we could trace this development of focus on practice, focus on diseases as categories, and focus on physical examination to this circle and the literature that they produced and that they edited and rearranged.
So let us shift our focus now to the patients. The latter half of your book talks in great detail about the lives of the patients in these Bimaristans. So first of all, what are the different kinds of people who were housed at these Bimaristans, who went there? And I think the reader is quite surprised to find out that the kinds of people who went to these Bimaristans actually is quite different from how we imagine that category of patient today from our modern eyes.
Right.
And you also talk a lot about the kinds of interactions they had with the physicians at the Bimaristan. So could you say a bit about the people who went there, their interactions with the physicians, and also what might it have been like for these patients to spend a day at the Bimaristan?
So first, to think about the types of patients that we're looking at. First, you're right. I mean, the hospital at the time, or the Bimaristan, was quite different from what we think about as a hospital today. It was a place that people tried essentially to avoid. People would go to the Bimaristan only if they really have to. And the Bimaristan was also able to dispense drugs and medication. So people could go and be examined in the Bimaristan and receive medications for free and take them home. And at certain times, the Bimaristan would actually send even the medications to people in their homes. And therefore, anyone who could afford to stay at home, meaning that anyone who had some form of family care or was able to care for themselves in one way or another, would actually stay in their own homes and just go to the Bimaristan to be examined and to receive medications. And as such, in any given day, if we stand right now in the middle of the courtyard of a 13th century or a 14th century Bimaristan, the majority of the people that we will encounter are actually people who will not stay in the Bimaristan, are actually what I call in the book prescription seekers, if you will. People who would come, be examined by the physicians, have certain medications prescribed, and would take these medications either from the Bimaristan's sort of herbalist or pharmacist, or from another herbalist close to the Bimaristan. Courtyards were very crowded. They were full of these people, sick people, mostly carried by or taken care of by their relatives, but in many cases also relatives of sick people who are coming to describe the conditions of their loved ones and take the medications or prescriptions from the Bimaristan. Now, if we move beyond this group and look at the other people who really compose the minority of the, if you will, the day traffic in the Bimaristan, but those who are staying in the Bimaristan in its halls, and we find a slightly different population. One group, which stands to be a very prominent and important group, is what I call in the book the clients of the charity network itself. So these are people, when we look at their biographies, they normally live in the mosques, for instance. They are either, some of them are what we would call Sufis or mystics or Mujawireen, they spend large parts of their lives in the mosques or in the khanaqas or in madrasas. Some of them don't work at all. Others work very sort of little jobs that support their lives, like copying, like carrying water, helping students and helping professors and so on. These people frequent the Bimaristan quite a bit. They don't have a family to care for them, and therefore, whenever they are sick, they have to be at the Bimaristan. And in many cases, we find them staying and then later on dying in one of these big sites of the charity network. Again, a matbakh or a kitchen, a mosque or a Bimaristan. So that's a significant group there that is a more, not necessarily significant in terms of number, but really a more stable population that one would probably encounter over and over again in these areas, centers of cities where we see the parts of this charity network. We have obviously groups of what I call in the book the urban poor. And I call them the urban poor because this is not really about or necessarily about lack of money, but primarily because they work in very specific urban
professions, which are very fragile professions, like, for instance, water sellers. And these or blacksmith working in the town, or cooks. Now, these professions do not they pay well, so these people have enough to support themselves on a daily basis, but they rely largely on physical power. They are very volatile, and so whenever they fall in sick, they suddenly become extremely poor and unable to care for themselves, and therefore they end up in these boomer stands. So, and within this population, we find other subcategories that are not necessarily poor, like travelers, for instance. So boomer stands became very important site for travelers. Now, these, again, might be actually quite well off in their own original countries, but as they pass through big cities on their way to pilgrimage or other travels, they are threatened by the unpredictability of life on the road, if you will, or life as a traveler. You are one pickpocket away from extreme poverty. And hospitals, and of course, they don't have families to care for them as well. So even if they have money, some of maybe not enough to hire a servant, and therefore they end up in the hospital. Students are also a very important subcategory of this group, of this urban population that relies on these charitable organizations or establishments to survive. And then we have a population of the mad or the mentally disturbed who were normally kept in a separate part of the hospital. And we have a lot of or significant evidence and accounts about how normally these people end in the hospital only when their conditions are extremely bad. So we find accounts of the mad or the mentally disturbed being well-dressed or well-spoken as always something that would surprise our authors. So whenever our authors are in the hospital and they see a mentally disturbed person who can speak well or who is well-dressed, this becomes extremely surprising. The reason is most of these mad who are locked in the hospital are usually ones who became too difficult to deal with outside and therefore end up in inside the hospital. So basically we have these different groups of people. We have obviously, finally, a group of chronic patients who are either disabled, chronically ill, and who stay for a long time in the hospital. And these are normally groups that physicians did not like as much, precisely because they kept occupying the beds for a long time. But again, they were a significant or a good part of the population of the hospital, as long as they were not able to depend on other institutions of charity around.
So, Ahmed, as we're coming to the end of our time, could you share with us what's the next project? What are you working on these days?
So I'm working on a new monograph about the history of prophetic medicine. As you and some of our listeners probably know, prophetic medicine is also a topic that is largely understudied, and it has been seen in some scholarship as a response to Galenic or Greek practice. In this book, I actually trace it to be rather a way of that actually it played a role in the popularization of Greek medicine and ancient sciences, and I try to link it and put it in sort of within the framework of the development of Hadith and Sirah, and how it is part of the making of this pietistic discourse around the life of the Prophet.
The Medieval Islamic Hospital by Ahmed Raghib, published by Cambridge University Press in 2015. Thank you so much, Ahmed, for such a wonderful book, a truly interdisciplinary masterpiece in so many ways, combining intellectual history, the study of medicine, architecture, political authority. So you've done some fascinating and brilliant work here. So thank you so much for this book, and thank you so much for your time today. Really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So this was my conversation with Professor Ahmed Raghib about his brilliant new book, The Medieval Islamic Hospital. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, and please also join us next time for another fresh episode. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.